When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Academic Life. This is a podcast for your academic journey and beyond. Today, I am so pleased to be joined by Dr. Mary Dana Hinton, who is the author of the new book, Leading from the Margins, College Leadership from Unexpected Places. Welcome to the show, Dr. Hinton.
Good day, Christina. It's so good to be with you. Thank you for this opportunity to share my work with the world around us.
I am so glad that you're here and we get to learn what it means to lead from the margins. Before we dive into that, will you please tell us about yourself?
Absolutely. As you said, I'm Mary Dana Hinton. I am quite proudly the president of Holland University in Roanoke, Virginia. I am president emerita of the College of St. Benedict in St. Joseph, Minnesota. I have spent about half of my career in the K-12 space and quite excitedly the other half in the higher education space. To know me is to know that my mission in life is educational equity and hoping that every young person has an opportunity to achieve an excellent education. And I'm particularly passionate about those who have historically been underrepresented in higher education. I believe every young person deserves a high-quality liberal arts education, and my mission, purpose, vocation, and calling is to make that available to them.
That mission is so in line with how this podcast got started. That makes me really pleased that you're here.
Well, thank you. Listeners
may not have had a chance to take a look at your book yet. Could you briefly tell them about Leading from the Margins, and then after that, we'll talk about what inspired you to write it.
Absolutely. So as you said, the book is titled Leading from the Margins, College Leadership from Unexpected Places. And I wrote this book because I had no choice, to be honest with you. There's a Maya Angelou quote that reads, "There is no agony like an untold story inside you." And I felt like I had a story that I needed to tell, a story about how one can be a leader, can view themselves as a leader, can actually achieve success leading when the world has told you that you are none of those things, that you're not a leader, that you're not entitled to have a leadership position, that you don't belong in leadership spaces. I wanted to write a book that rejected that notion. I wanted to write a book that rejected that you had to meet some criteria to be a leader that was set without you in mind. I wanted to write a book that encourages the hearts, the spirits, and the minds of people who have been denied access. I wanted to write a book, most of all, Christina, that says to all the folks in the margins, folks like me, I believe in you. You are uniquely equipped to be a leader, and I want to journey with you. So that's what's behind the book, Leading from the Margins.
In the book, you share quite a bit of your personal story. It's difficult when writing a book to know how much of our story is ours and how much is someone else's and how much to share. You also talk in the book about how women leaders are not supposed to be vulnerable. They're not supposed to have emotions. And you push back on that by again and again offering us your authenticity. Can you give us some of your backstory that's shared in the book?
Absolutely. So I want to actually start, Christina, by saying that when in the first iteration of the book, I actually didn't have as much of myself in it as the book resulted in. I still struggle sometimes, less each day, I hope, but I still struggle sometimes with being vulnerable, particularly being vulnerable in print, particularly being vulnerable when you have no idea how the reader is going to receive what you've shared. So the Greg Britton at Johns Hopkins Press pushed me a bit on sharing more of myself, and I'm grateful for that. But I want to share that sort of caveat at the beginning, because I don't want anyone to think any person has it all figured out. I'm living in the margins every day, trying to make sense, trying to make a pathway for others. But one of the things that I've come to realize as a leader is that to lead, you have to share yourself. So we are often given this centric notion of leadership, that a leader is, and this is stereotypically male, you know, definitive and confident and competent, and it's lonely at the top and they don't need other people. I actually don't find that that resonates for me and in my experience. And I would suggest it may not resonate for a lot of people from the margins. What happens when you have that centric notion of what it means to be a leader is you discount yourself. It took me a really long time to realize that it is, in fact, my story that gives strength to my leadership. It's my story that enables me to be in relationship with the people in the community. So my story is one of growing up a Black girl in the rural South in poverty. That's my story. So all the things that you imagine when I describe that are part of my story. And Christina, I spent so much of my life trying to hide that. That's part of the agony that I carried with me for a long time. I went to public schools for most of my K-12 career. I only was able to get out of my local public school when a guidance counselor told me that Black women don't go to college. She told me that I was going to live a very small life. She told me that the world didn't believe in me. In that one phrase, Black women don't go to college, she attempted to reduce who I could be in the world. And the family my mother cleaned for, the Cooper family, paid for me to go to an all-girls boarding school for the last 2 years of high school. And that really changed my life. But you don't trot off to Williams College with a story of poverty. You don't go into these academic spaces having to tell people your mom's a maid. So I tried to pack those things away. I worked so hard, Christina, to get rid of my Southern accent because I didn't want people to know I was from the rural South. I didn't understand then that that was a pervasive bias that other people needed to account for. I thought I had to change myself. And I think that's the message so many people in the margins are given, that you have to change yourself to meet some sort of criteria that you nor your ancestors had any voice in setting. And so it was out of those experiences, it was out of a continual need to confront bias that I wrote this book. And you can't tell people how they might be able to make it through the journey without sharing how you made it through the journey. So that's why there's more of me in this book than I originally intended. But can I tell another story, Christina, something that I think is might be helpful for listeners, particularly those who are looking at leadership roles, to consider?
Absolutely. Tell us all the stories you'd like.
Well, thank you. So when I first became a college president in 2014, I, at that moment, had in my mind that there is a certain way to be a college president. And I was already defying my preconceived notions because I was, and I think I still am, a reluctant college president. It's not necessarily what I viewed for myself. As I said at the outset, my mission is educational equity, and And I just, that's what I want. I'm not particular about a title. I'm particular about achieving that mission. But in any case, when I first became a college president, I had an opportunity to talk with someone, and it was Earl Lewis at the Mellon Foundation at the time. And I said to Earl, I'm really wrestling because I want so much of my background and experience to frame my leadership, but I'm told that's not how we're supposed to lead. I'm told that I should not be influenced by the struggles I had growing up. I'm told I'm not supposed to lead in an effort to right wrongs that I witness in the world. I'm told that I should maintain the status quo when the status quo is breaking people. And he gave me really good advice. He said, Mary, you can only lead from your experience. Your background is what will give depth and richness to your leadership. And I share that today because I know a lot of people in leadership roles probably think there is an objective standard to which they need to rise in order to be a leader. And I don't think that's the case. Certainly, you do not treat leadership as a vanity project. That's out of bounds. But I do think those things that bring you into this work are things which will help you be a better leader. For example, because I was a impoverished kid in college, I have a very keen eye for policies that discriminate against kids based on their economic standing, as well as any other demographic standings. Because I know what it's like to feel like a stranger on a campus, I go out of my way to create a community where every student, faculty, and staff member feels welcome, seen, and heard. Because I know what it's like to feel like a stranger when you go home and you're working on something you're peers or sometimes even your family don't approve of, I know that it's important to reach out to students and say they are enough. So while the center often wants us to put up these firewalls between self and work, between the background that brought you to a place and your current experiences, I just want to gently push back on that. And if it's needed, give people permission to think about how their experiences in the margins equip them to lead. I tell people all the time, I'm not the leader I am despite the margins. I'm the leader I am because of the margins.
Early on in the book, you take us to when you were very young and you're still in public school and you have to take this bubble test. You have to very carefully fill in the correct answer in this little bubble using the exact right kind of pencil. And to start you off on this test, which you liked, you were good at the standardized test. It was about close reading, correctly identifying what answer they wanted to give. This, you could game this. You knew how to do this. You were ready. But you got stopped right at the beginning because they had these demographic questions about your family of origin. And you got very stuck on an option that wasn't there, which ended up like foreshadowing where you are now in your life and marriage. Right. Can you give listeners this story? Because I loved it. I just had to just put the book down and sit with how much I loved that story before I moved forward.
That means all the world to me, Christina. It's funny. There are large patches of life that I don't remember. And I don't mean that in any sort of pathological way. It's just, you go through life and some things you retain and some things you don't. But I am 100% able to recall exactly where I was sitting in the classroom for this particular career placement type exam. And I remember, even as I sit here now, I can remember exactly what that paper smelled like, right? I remember thinking this was my moment to shine in the world, Christina. I didn't have a lot of shining moments when I was an adolescent, and this was my moment to shine. And so you're right. I took out that sheet of paper. Remember how number two pencils would smell when they're freshly sharpened? Like, that's that energy that I'm gonna, I am going to game this. And so I sit down and I'm looking at the options. So, you know, you fill in your name and you bubble that in. I probably put in my birth date. I had to write my address. And then because of the times, they were going to ask about your parents. And so they gave a few options and you could only pick one option, which in and of itself, as I look back now, we were so determined everyone had to fit into this, you know, preconceived box, but you could only pick one option. Mr. and Mrs. Mr. and Ms. MS. But I often say you could feel the shame next to that one. You weren't supposed to pick that in the rural South in the 80s. You could pick Dr. and Mrs. And then I think they had some single ones like Mr. and Miss. But I'm looking at that and I see Dr. and Mrs. and I'm looking for the parallel to that. Dr. and Mr. So I'm looking at this and I got a little fixated on it because I started thinking, why isn't there a Dr. and Mr.? I remember looking at it again and I'm thinking, why can I not be a doctor married to a man? Now there's all sorts of implied heteronormativity in this whole thing. And I want to acknowledge that. But at that moment, sitting in school doing this test, I just got so caught up on the absence of Dr. and Mr. So I blew the test. Christina, I didn't only not game the test, like I performed horribly on it. Like I think it said something like, you're never going to get a job. I mean, I did terribly on this test. But little did I know that in that moment, there was something being born in my spirit that absolutely influences my life today. It was in that moment that a little womanist was born in this schoolroom because I was determined. And once I'm determined about something, it's really hard to stop me. But I was determined that I wanted to live in a world where Dr. and Mr. would be a more than acceptable option. I wanted to live in a world where a woman didn't have to be defined by the title of her spouse or partner. I wanted to live in a world where a Mr. might actually love a doctor. And so I think that was when a deep commitment to women's education that I couldn't even have articulated on that day or for many years afterwards, but I attribute that moment as the moment when that was born in my heart and in my mind. It turns out, you know, so that moment now is complicated again by the implied heteronormativity in it. But it turns out I did marry a Mr. And Mr. is married to a doctor, but I share in the book, we don't have the same name. And so we are never Dr. and Mr. I realize now that it actually doesn't matter at all, but I will always be grateful to that fraught moment because it birthed something in me. It birthed a deep passion for the rights of women to determine for themselves what they wanted, to not have to feel that they had to sublimate their professional desires in order to be in relationship with someone else.
I saw a through line between that story and what the guidance counselor did, because I think many of us had something awful happen with an adult in charge and we never went to a parent or caregiver and said, mm-hmm. And it may have changed what we saw as our options, but you went to your mom. Mm-hmm. And your mom felt in you and in herself a passion to write this. And so she went to someone else. This didn't have to go the way that it did. If you mm-hmm. hadn't early on identified mm-hmm. things for yourself, if your mom hadn't early on, these paths would have perhaps gone forward, but in a twistier way. Yeah. I see this through line of these stories.
Yeah. Yeah, that's, you know, that is even more complicated than I think I share in the book for a few reasons, Christina. I do share in the book that my mom was not one who asked for help lightly. So to know my mom and to know my story is to know that she was born in 1926 in rural North Carolina and was never afforded a birth certificate. So when she died on August 4th, 2020, she died without a birth certificate. In the world into which she was born, she was deemed as less than human, and she died without that document, despite efforts to get that for her. And so my mother had a very nuanced and complicated view of asking for help. She felt very strongly that if you wanted something, you had to do it on your own and for yourself. So when she told me I needed to go talk to my guidance counselor about getting into college, I was a kid who did what I was told. And when I had to come home that day and tell my mother that the guidance counselor said that Black women don't go to college, I knew that wasn't going to go well because I had not done what my mother told me. And it turns out my mother actually didn't say a lot then. But in my mind, I imagine she spent much of that night trying to figure out what to do next, because she had told me my whole life that an education is the most important thing. And my mother was able to achieve an education through the eighth grade, but was not able to go further. But as the smartest person I knew, she knew that I had to get an education for myself, for my family, for the community, and in order to serve. So the day after my guidance counselor told me that, the day after I experienced perhaps the greatest vitriol I've experienced in this life, my mother went to the people for whom she worked and asked them for help. And I think it's so important to tell that story because it speaks to how deeply my mother loved me. It speaks to how much she believed in education, because she had to sacrifice a part of who she was to make this possible. And so because the Cooper family were and are just a wonderful group of human beings, they immediately responded. They immediately said, we can get married to a different school. Now, I just want to add one thing here, Christina. I don't want anyone who works in public education to think that I'm deriding all of public education. I'm deriding an experience that I had in a school that I went to with a person. And part of the reason why it was important for me in the first half of my career to work in K-12 in public education is because I believe they have the most important work that we need to do. I still believe that. I work every day to partner with our public school systems to give kids an opportunity to go to college. So I just want to say that. But the fact that I was able to go to this other school changed the course of my life. What it did most of all, though, Christina, was it made me realize that, as you said, it was very twisty. And I would say I got very lucky. And I don't want another young person to have to get that lucky in order to access an education. So the reason why my mission and my vocation are educational equity is because I want every child to automatically have access to an outstanding education. I don't want them to have a lucky break, to walk a twisty path. My story could have and probably would have turned out quite differently if I had not had that one lucky shot. And I just want to give other kids an opportunity without having to have luck as a factor.
When you talk about leading from the margins, one of the things you tell us about halfway through the book on page 74 is that you have resistance to asking for help. You share stories about the strong women in your family and how important they were to you, the summers that you spent learning about their different jobs from them and spending time with them. You say your mom is the co-star of your story, and you show us how she is really self-sufficient and strong. How do you learn how and where to ask for help in a life where you've depended so much on yourself and seen the people that you admire depending so much on themselves?
Why, that is a good question, Christina. My immediate response is that learning to ask for help, much like learning to be vulnerable or learning to be in deep relationship with people, is something of a practice. And I mean that in the yoga practice sense of the word, that it's something that you have to do and you have to refine and you have to learn over and over and over again. For me, it is easier to ask for help when it's in service to someone else. So what I mean by that is, if I were to just ask for help for myself independently, I would wrestle with that more. It would be harder for me than when I ask for help for a student. So I'll use fundraising as an example. As a college president, a lot of my life is spent fundraising. I love fundraising. I never thought I would say that. I love it because I'm not asking people just for money. I'm asking people to touch the future by giving a young woman an opportunity. So I love doing that. I love asking for help, if you will, in that way, because it's helping someone else. I don't mind at all asking for help to forward the mission of educational equity. But it's something that I had to and continue every day to have to practice. When I do personally need help, it's a little harder, but I have people in my life who help me work through that. And I think that that's really important. But learning to be vulnerable is the same way. Being vulnerable is not just spewing all of your stuff out in the universe. It's a practice of how do you share in ways that are meaningful for the person with whom you're sharing and meaningful for you. How do you share in ways that are appropriate? How do you share in ways that are not exploitative? How do you share in ways that don't mess up a power that don't reinforce an unhealthy power dynamic? How are you vulnerable in ways that are learning opportunities for you? When you think about being in relationship with a community of people, how do you do that in ways that enable the entire community move forward while recognizing that a community is really a collective of human hearts? So with all of those difficult topics, you practice. You don't practice on other people. I don't mean it in a way of using people, but you practice in community and with people. And you let people know, my team has heard me say around the cabinet table, this is hard for me to ask for your help. Can you help me ask you for help? But I have to name that so that I can get better at it. But I also name it so my team knows that when they need help, they can name it and I will be there for them. Does that make sense, Christina?
It does. You're preaching to the choir.
Tell me how that works for you, Christina. Tell me a little bit about the asking for help for you.
It really resonated. I can think of a couple of fundraisers that I created because I saw what would happen if I didn't do it. Yeah. And it happened. It was small grassroots. It wasn't, scalable, but it did what I set out to do. And I didn't, I don't know how to put it. I lost myself in it. Yeah. I lost my stutter, my self-consciousness, my stage fright, all of it, because it had nothing to do with me. It had to do with that I could make some time.
Right.
to do something that no one was doing anything about, and it was solvable.
Yeah.
And I wasn't going to directly benefit from the results, but I could see that the results aligned with my beliefs, missions, values, that type of thing. Yeah. And I didn't, you know, expect anything out of it. So it was easier to ask for help. It's much harder if I see myself as embedded in the system that will be supported.
Yeah. And we get to wrestle with that, Christina. I mean, I think there's this notion that we don't get to wrestle with that, or that we've got to figure it all out. And I don't know. I think we want to be thinking about these issues. Why is it hard for us? And how do we live into our purpose when things are difficult? You started your comment with, if I didn't do it, no one else would. And my immediate thought was, ooh, I've got to write a book titled, If I Didn't Do It. Because I think that's such a powerful phrase. And I think that's what compels us to action in so many ways. If I didn't do it, when you're someone from the margins, I think you've often had experiences where you just had to do it because it otherwise wouldn't get done. And you respond to that call to action. And I hope that as people read this book, that they realize that there are things that only they can do. What you did, Christina, was something that only you could do. There are needs in our world that can be solved, but someone has to pick up the mantle with the confidence that they can do it. And I think too often we're told that if we're not a certain type of person, if we don't fit this leadership image or model, if we don't fit what the center wants of us, then we can't do it. We're not capable or competent. And I just want to push back on it. There are things that only you can do, things that only I can do. And thank God the world has all of these people in it, so that we each have a mission, a purpose, a vocation, and we can solve all manner of problems. I look at my students sometimes, and I look at their deep commitment to sustainability and climate justice, and I'm so grateful to them that that is what they are focused on, because they can do it in a way that I can't, and I'm just really happy. And it's when we recognize our interdependence as a community and as human beings, that interdependence is so important. And I'm just really, really grateful.
At the end of chapter 4, you tell us that being in the margins grants the permission needed to not play the same games that are played in the center. We have been using the word margins and center quite a lot. Can we define that type of positionality and then talk about what games we're seeing in the center that people who have wisdom from the margins can create a different way and not engage in those games?
Yeah. So when I think of the margins, I think about those folks who have historically been excluded, underrepresented. You know, so I'll use myself as an example, but I think about women, people of color. I think about low-income folks, people with various abilities. I think about our LGBTQIA community members. I think about folks who have just historically been excluded. I think about the center as those people who have for so long had the privilege of not thinking about all the people in the margins, even when people in the margins have to focus so much of their lives on thinking about and understanding and conforming to the needs of the center. I think about the center as those folks who got to, quote unquote, write the rules for everyone without even recognizing there were other people involved. that doesn't mean that there aren't people in the center who are allies. There are plenty of allies in the center. The family my mother cleaned for are among those folks. They were people who chose to support the margin. So I don't want it to sound like there aren't people in the center who support the margins. There are, but sometimes in a talk I share this idea that people from the margins cannot exist without thinking about it in the context of the center's needs. People from the margins can't even exist without thinking about it in the context of the center's needs. What I'm calling for us to do is to think about what people in the margins need, to not have our goal be the center, to think about life in different ways. So I want to use an example, Christina, that came up in our sort of pre-conversation. We were talking about the use of formal titles. And as a Black woman, having the PhD credential is really important to me. I worked really hard for it. And I used to be very, very particular about its usage. And then one day it occurred to me that the center has framed my academic credential as being the most important part of me. Well, you'll remember I talked about my mother who didn't even have a high school diploma. A lot of people I care deeply about were never allowed to have access to this credential. And so at some point it became less important to me to define myself by that credential. And I share that not to suggest by any stretch how other people should feel about it, but I have reached a point where just because the center says a PhD makes me legitimate, I no longer choose to view that degree as such. It is a degree. I'm so proud of it. I'm so proud of the work I did and how hard I worked. But if it's my PhD that's going to make you take me seriously, then I probably don't need to be with you. I hope what would make someone take me seriously is that I'm a human being with a heart and hopes and dreams and aspirations. I would hope that people would take me seriously without this credential. And so for me, and again, this is my choice, and it's not a choice that I declare others should or have to make, but for me, I want people to know me as more than just my credential. I want people to respect me for more than just my credential. I want people who will never have access to this credential to be afforded the same respect that some give me only because of that degree. I remember I was at a doctor's appointment once, and this doctor was sort of the worst example of bedside manner. And I said, I'm not sure if you understand who you're talking to, but I am highly credentialed, and rattled off my degrees. And he, you know, sort of made a face and reapproached with a different manner. But I said to him, it should not matter if I have every degree or no degree. You need to treat me like a human being who has worth and value. And I think that was the moment when I began for myself to rethink this. Does that make sense? Does that help, Christina?
It does. And I appreciated our off-air conversation because I do introduce guests with titles. There's always a conversation about using titles before we begin taping. But and I've heard so many stories about why people use them or why they introduce themselves with it because of the privilege other people assume in naming you on your behalf.
Right, right. Right. I think the way we had that conversation was really helpful to me, Christina. And I think it's a choice every person gets to make for themselves. I think for some people, it really matters to how they view themselves. Maybe that's ultimately what it comes down to. is how you view yourself and what strengthens your spirit and your heart. I have reached a point where, for me, what strengthens my spirit and my heart is us being in conversation with one another. There was a point, a valuable point in my life, where the credentials strengthened my heart. And maybe we're allowed to go through stages. There may be another point again when I will find it even more important to use a particular title. There are moments when in my head I'm telling someone off starting with my title, but then I have to think, is that who I want to be? And so I think we get to have complicated relationships with these things.
And you invite us into the complexity of identity again and again in the book. You talk about how there's this interplay between creating our own identity, our own sense of self, and the assumptions that others bring to or put upon us, and the created structures of the world that name identity factors for us. And we're always in sort of co-conversation between the two, between our inner self and the outer world.
Yeah. Yeah, I love that phrase, co-conversation between the two. And I think what I hope will happen as a result of the book, what I hope is happening in my own life, what I hope is happening in the lives of others, is that we are willing to recognize that we get to lead that co-conversation. Yes, the world is always going to look at me and make a set of assumptions based on what they see. And I'm not responsible for that. I'm not in charge of that. What I am responsible for and in charge of is how I react to that. And I don't want to give the world the power to decide how I feel about myself, what I have to offer to the world, how I develop my leadership. I want to own that for myself. I want to be able to say, call me doctor or call me Mary. I want to be able to say, I am deeply committed to inclusion. I'm also a fierce proponent for the liberal arts. I want to be able to say that I care deeply about X and Y without having the world decide whether or not that's right for me. I believe that every human being has dignity and worth, and that the greatest gift in life is to be able to live into that on one's own terms. And for too long, people in the margins are told you don't get to do that, that your life is set by the terms of those in the center. And I want to free myself, and I want to free others from that notion. I find it stultifying. I find it takes my freedom away as a human being. I find that it gives other people more power and say in my life and in my journey than I want them to have. And so I assume we wrestle with this our entire lives, but I want to wrestle with it now from a point of being in charge of it myself.
In the book, you take us through a section where we go through the literature on women leaders. And you point out that a lot of the advice for women leaders relies on privilege, such as leaning in and knowing your value. If you're leading from the margins, you've spent quite a lot of time dealing with people who try to tell you you don't have value. Mm-hmm. And that a lot of these studies of women leaders and how they were evaluated and why they weren't promoted was because there was a inability to see their work as leading, even if they did the same work that their male peers did. Yeah. And there was a high regard for women's likability. If you're in the margins, you're often there because the center denies your likability.
Right. Right. They deny your likability, or they only see your likability and assume there's not more there besides that. The center wants to make you choose. Maybe that's the way to think about it, Christina, in a way that I've talked about in some other writings that I've done. The center wants to make you choose. And so there's this notion, particularly for women, and in the book I talk about some of the research from the perspective of white women and Black women. I know there's likely research for other identities out there, but this is what I'm most familiar with. So the research talks about how for white women, and we've heard this forever, but for white women, you have to be likable. You have to be kind. People have to want to be with you. But if you're too likable, then you're not seen as having power, or you're not seen as a leader. I think the word in the study is you are no longer agentic. You have no power because you're too likable. So in the research, it talks about women, white women in particular, needing to not be too likable. But of course, you can't be, quote, shrill. You can't be brusque. You can't be, I think we all know the word that's used for women. You can't be that, right? Black women face a very different challenge. And I've seen this an awful lot in my career. So Black women are often, the de facto assumption is Black women are angry, or Black women are loud, or Black women are aggressive. And so for a long time, to try to counter that narrative, I myself would try to do things that would make me appear less angry, less aggressive. I'm not angry or aggressive. And if I were angry and aggressive, I think the world gives me plenty good reason to be those things. But in order to be a leader, I was told, you know, you have to be nicer, you have to be quieter, you have to be gentle with people. So Black women are, as this study says, navigating a different lose-lose dilemma. Because if we're too aggressive, we're angry and we're off-putting. But we can't be so nice as to be seen as powerless. And so at the end of the day, all women are being asked to make a choice that fits the center. When the choice I want to make is the choice of how to be true to myself and who I am in the margins to help other people be successful.
We're starting to run out of time. You brought up one of the studies that talks about the glass cliff. And I think that's a term that we don't know enough about. Could we briefly talk about, we've heard so much about the glass ceiling. What is the glass cliff, and why do women need to be wary and mindful that it exists?
Yeah, Ryan and Haslam, I think in 2005, first published an article about the glass cliff. And I believe that was the first use of that phrase. But the glass cliff is simply an observation that women and people of color are more often invited into leadership roles in times of, and they were researching the corporate world, but in times of corporate downturn, when a business isn't doing so well, that's when they'll bring women and people of color in. The challenge with that glass cliff is that you are predisposed to failure. So women and people of color aren't brought in during the great times. They are brought in during more difficult times, which predisposes them for failure, predisposes them to failure. And so you want to be really mindful of that. And I say this to aspiring presidents all the time. When a search firm is contacting you, do every bit of due diligence, because one, you're more likely to be brought into a difficult situation that you have to fix. And two, according to the ACE presidential study in 2023, women and people of color cite getting fewer disclosures about the state of the organization before joining it. So what that means, Christina, is that women and people of color are less likely to be told about how difficult the circumstances are when they're invited in to lead a college or university than are white males. So we're on this glass cliff already. We're already more likely to be put in a difficult circumstance. And according to the ACE study, likely to get fewer disclosures about how difficult that is. So as I say in the book, even when women are given an opportunity, it's an unequal opportunity, and you have to do all of your homework along the way.
Again and again in the book, you invite us to rely on our own leadership compass. You tell us there is no one way that women lead. And at the end of each chapter, you give us thought questions to examine our positionality, why we believe we have that positionality, to look into our different beliefs and hopes. At the end of the book, you invite us to frame our own story around what we have accomplished despite where we may have come from, to frame our successes around because of where we came from. And you use the book to bridge the gap between theory and lived experiences to encourage women as leaders. In the few minutes we have left, what do you hope listeners will take away?
My most fervent hope, Christina, is that someone will read this book and see their own journey, see their hopes reflected, that someone will read this book and take a minute to just stop and ponder what's in their heart, what would they like to do. I hope someone will read this book and know that there's another person in the world cheering for them, which I am. I hope someone will read this book and be encouraged. I hope someone will read this book and leave with a deep sense of hope. You know, the last chapter, and it's only a couple of pages, it's called What If? And one of the questions sort of midway through that is, what if instead of shrinking who you are to fit into the world, you expand the world by sharing your full self and truth? So perhaps what I want most of all is for the reader to decide that they are going to go out into the world and share their full selves and their truth.
Thank you so much for being here today, Dr. Mary Dana Hinton, and sharing Leading from the Margins, College Leadership from Unexpected Places. You've been listening to The Academic Life. I'm the show's producer and host, Dr. Christina Gessler, inviting you to please join us again.